A bona fide festival of print, as ModMag rolls around once more. We'll hear from some of the most exciting titles in the field, taking in everything from footy to botany, glossies, and one of the most esteemed heritage publications on the whole planet. That's all to come on this week's edition of The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Now, regular listeners to the programme will be more than familiar with ModMag, the annual celebration of independent print publications held by Mag Culture. From their base in London, they tirelessly promote periodicals and publishing. And at ModMag, their annual shindig, their efforts are brought into sharp relief as luminaries from across the industry gather to share their stories of success and failure, trial and error, to an audience of all magazine enthusiasts. Jeremy Leslie's the man behind it. He was telling us about it a few weeks ago. We'll hear from Jeremy in a moment. But first, we'll hear from Monocle's own Augustin Macellari, who attended the event earlier this week. And Aug, I gather that was your first time visiting ModMag. It's a good old day out, isn't it?
Indeed, it was great. A lovely bunch of people. Lots of people in the audience actually working on making magazines there and then.
So we're going to actually hear from a number of the people that you had the good fortune to meet at ModMag. Jeremy Leslie, of course, amongst them. And maybe we'll kick off by hearing from Jeremy. What did he have to say? Because he was sort of trailing the event a few weeks ago and talking about how to keep things fresh, how to change up the lineup, the structure of the day and all the rest of it. Was he in a good mood? Probably a bit busy.
Yeah, he was quite rushed. I think he just lost one of his guests when I buttonholed him. I don't have much of a frame of reference on ModMag as a kind of 6-year-long thing, having not been before, but this year was really outstanding from my perspective. Had this theme of transformation, really, like I say, brought together this kind of community feeling. Lots of people there, some of them working really hard to make their magazines profitable, some of them just finding their feet in terms of even breaking even. But what came through was what a labour of love it really is. Also, what's interesting is the fact that he is into magazines 365 days of the year. Like, he lives and breathes magazines. So ModMag is this kind of one day every year when he gets to kind of appraise what's going on, what's happened over the course of the year, distill it into a day. And that's what he kicked off by discussing.
Having the deadline of putting together this event gives me the opportunity to pull on all the kind of things that have happened through the year. So it's almost the other way around. It's like throughout the year, we're taking the temperature and judging what's happening. Then when it comes to putting together a lineup to fill a day, you actually sort of look back through the posts on the journal and you check out who should be appearing. And it's a chance to sit back and take stock and figure out, so what matters, what's interesting from the last year.
And what have you realised?
I think what's interesting right now, today's theme is reinvention, and I think you're looking at, our keynote speaker later today will be Emmett Smith, the creative director from National Geographic. They've put a huge investment into relaunching their print magazine and redesigning it and recreating it, building on that long kind of 130-year history that they have embedded in their brand and their project, but preparing it for the future. And I think what we're seeing now is a return to an understanding that print really matters. All us print lovers, we've been running this for 6 years now. We've been beating the drum, and I think now everyone is beginning to join in with us.
We had an amazing presentation earlier from you on covers that really showed the kind of extremely powerful political visual impact that magazines have, and that maybe the internet kind of can't really replicate just by virtue of the kind of barrage of information that's everywhere on it.
I think that's a fair point. Again, I would turn that on its head and just I'd make the point that rather than print and digital being at variance with each other, I think, one of the great things that's happening now with the excitement around front covers is their appearance on Instagram and social media. They're really powerful, iconic tools, none less so than Edel Rodriguez's covers for Time and Der Spiegel concerning Trump. The illustrations are really powerful. But the key thing with him is he makes his artwork available for download online so that people can print them out and use the anti-Trump images at protests. So I think the two are absolutely symbiotic.
Jeremy Leslie there, our good friend, the man behind ModMag, of course, and talking about community, and I guess that's what you've already mentioned at the top of the show, or how striking that is, this sense of people with similar goals, different maybe ways of working and all the rest, but there's a real sense of camaraderie and of some shared purpose, which is always quite powerful. Let's maybe pick up on that theme with a couple of the other people to whom you spoke at the event. I know you caught up with Dan Sanderson, who's from Mundial, the football magazine. And obviously football's really interesting because it's long been covered in the newspaper medium, of course, and it's had its own glossies. But there's been a real explosion of titles that are more sort of independent in character, looking at the beautiful game. What did he have to talk about?
Right, so Dan, you know, is interesting. Obviously, he is representing a kind of global community of football fans. He was fascinating talking about it because at one point, which we'll hear, he said that the game itself is almost a bit of an intrusion sometimes. It's the peripheral culture that happens. And he spoke about how, you know, with Virgil Abloh waking up to football as a cultural thing, it's become trendy. As football culture has taken on this mainstream success, Mundial, which was founded in 2014 on the occasion of the World Cup that year and was only ever intended to be a one-off, has kind of had to grow, really. So he was interesting talking about how Mundial has gone about growing.
It's kind of always been second nature to most people who work on the magazine, fortunately, because that's just how they grew up. They grew up going to the match. They're from a certain background, or their dads took them to the match, or their mums took them to the match, whatever it is. They kind of grew up around that. It wasn't like, we need to tap into this market. It was like, we love this thing. This is what we've grown up doing. This is what we love doing every weekend, which is the travel around the game, the friendships that build up around it, the fashion, the style, the kind of the things you drink, the things you eat, is all part of one package. And as I said in the talk, it's like we've always said, me and Seb, who co-founded the magazine, is that the match kind of gets in the way. And I think if you ask a lot of week in, week out football fans, they'll tell you the same. They still love their team. It's not 100% true. They still want their team to win, and they want to win trophies and stuff. But maybe it's 50-50, and the other 50% of it is everything around the game. What is interesting in is that the rest of the world seems to be kind of catching up onto that and understanding that, oh, it's not just Neymar and Mbappe and Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. There's a culture around this game.
You were founded in 2014 on the occasion of the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And initially that was that one-off kind of issue was the goal. You've sort of increased supply to meet demand. Mm-hmm. And now you're in a position where you're pivoting so that you have a staff of, what, 8 people who are full-time employed by the magazine. How has that process kind of realised itself? Presumably there's been some luck, but also there must at your end be a bit of like entrepreneurial drive to kind of get that going.
Yeah, it's trial and error. 99% of it is trial and error. Like, we've had a lot of good advice. We've got some mentors who kind of look after us and tell us where we've gone wrong in the past, where we maybe need to focus. There's a little bit of intuition. We have some experienced staff who've been at magazines before, who've been super helpful with Mundial to ensure that we don't make the mistakes they made in a previous life. And to grow the staff from 2 to 8 in what's been 2 years, it's just been as and when we could. And there's always that leap of like, can we afford this new person? And you never quite can. But you have to be like, you have to have that leap of faith to be, okay, well, if you come in now, we'll do enough work and we'll prove ourselves enough that your wages will be there at the end of next month. And it's still like that. And I think it'll be like that for the foreseeable, because we want to remain independent. Not that it'd be easy to go out and get someone else's money, but we've kind of made a clean decision that this is the way we want to do it. We want to manage it. We want to do it organically, I suppose.
Interesting reflections from Dan Sanderson from Mundial there, Org. And one thing I think which he was reflecting on there is this idea of independence. And obviously that's not just a sort of editorial positioning thing. That's a kind of state of mind that actually is relevant to probably virtually every title that you were hearing about on the day, and certainly the editors with whom you caught up.
That and trial and error. You know, there's a lot of people there who are now running publications that from the outside look really successful, and they were very unapologetic about saying, look, you know, distribution, logistics, these are things that are difficult and that we had to work out ourselves. Lots of unglamorous stories about editors physically taking copies of their magazine round to different shops and touting them. This is Carol Mumpart. She's a great example of this kind of more ad hoc-y publication. She is the creative director of a magazine called The Plant, which is definitely one of the most beautiful magazines that was on offer on the day. A bit like Mundial, it leverages a core concept, in Mundial's case football, in this case plants and botany, to explore a kind of wider cultural movement. The Plant itself as a magazine was launched before that. It was launched in 2012. Since then, it has just been this real labour of love. What's interesting is that, as Carol explained, it hasn't gone into the black. It's not making profit, but its cultural capital is so strong that they're able to leverage this extraordinary roster of contributors to contribute to the magazine.
I'm glad that some people think that it's like a profit-making, because it's still not. And I'm sure a lot of people in the industry of the magazine and the publishing world know exactly what I mean. Believe me when I say The Plant is a love project. We are three people. Three of us have our own job on the side. And the time invested in it is purely a passion that we've got to come up with these two issues every year. There's also really interesting to see how magazines have emerged in the last 2-3 years. And I guess social media is definitely helping, but you know, I would love to know how, you know, magazines start these days and start as a business. For us, it's been really hard to do so. There's been like chances of investment, etc., but then you sort of lose the control of things and you compromise what the product is. So it is really, really hard work economically, but we are keeping it up and trying to keep going. And for now, it's working, and I hope it works for a few more years.
I suppose beyond making a profit, there are different metrics of success. And one of the ones that you touched upon in the It's Nice That Thing and mentioned again today was access and contributors. I've heard you talk about bringing Tilda Swinton in to write an article. In the forthcoming issue, you have original writing by Paul McCartney. Mm. How has that played out as you've kind of developed more of a reputation? How has it been to see that recognition reflected in the scope of what you're able to do?
This is interesting because the Tilda Swinton, in fact, that was early days. That was issue 3 or 4. I think people like the fact that The Plant is not a business. And I tend to, maybe it's not that obvious, but when I listen to people talking about The Plant, people really actually like it and they feel good about contributing with us. In the case of Tilda Swinton, it was just an email, and then, you know, sending her a copy, and she immediately fell in love with the project and just wanted to contribute. And I mean, same with Paul McCartney. And I think it's very important for us to send a copy. So when we want to collaborate with someone, send an email, first contact, and then we send a copy. And then when they see the magazine, they probably see what we mean. We've been very lucky so far. We had like great, amazing contributors. We've got artists like Jeremy Deller, Camille Henrod, Nobuyoshi Araki, you know, shot the cover of the previous issue. So we've been lucky, but it's always because they love the project. There's unfortunately, there's never like a money exchange there, because, you know, we are always like tight on budget. But, you know, I think like they just really enjoyed contributing and working with us, and we love working with them too.
Carol Mompart from Plant there, and Carol's no stranger actually around Midori House. Interesting to hear from her, and that's a beautiful publication. I guess sometimes it's easy to be carried away by how wonderful something looks, its tactile qualities in print, and not to think about the business side of things as well, and having to be a manager as well as an editor. Was this idea of being alive to the opportunities and the necessities that are involved with stewarding any title, whether that's how to get the revenue up to how to function across digital and print, the modern mags I've attended, that's always been, you know, if not the main theme, it's always very much the elephant in the room. Presumably other people that you spoke to were keen to address that. You need to look at the ones and zeros at the end of the day as well.
For sure, it was definitely something that came up a lot. I mean, what was as important was this idea of cross-platform offering. The death of print has long been touted. We'll hear more about that later. It's proving to be nonsense, but that's not to say that people don't have to work on their online platforms to drive an audience towards print. Perrin Drum, who's the founder and director of Ion Design, was a kind of really great case study in doing that successfully. They have taken this online-only platform. They've now started bringing out these publications. They're only 2 in, and it's already kind of doing extremely well. And it's in the publications that they allow their designers to really push the boundaries and to experiment with form. So she explained to me how important it has been for them to get this online audience across into print and the success that can be made of that.
I don't think we could have ever been as successful as we were straight out of the gate with print if we hadn't spent a little over 3 years really strongly cultivating an online audience, both with our daily website where we publish 1, 2, sometimes 3 stories a day, and then we do quite a lot with social media. So we spent a long time really finding who our reader was and learning how to speak to them really well, so that when we launched our magazine, we sort of had this ready audience waiting to buy it.
You were saying that it's also important that while the two inform each other and complement one another, you try and keep the content separate. You want to be putting forward new and maybe different things in the magazine than you would online.
Right. We never replicate the content that we produce either in print. We don't put that on the website, and we don't put stuff from the website in the print magazine. We treat them as two distinct platforms as they are. We do still cover the same topics, meaning we write about gender and sexuality and politics and money and education and all the ways that they intersect with design and graphic design, but we treat them very differently. So online is sort of our bread and butter in that it's the easiest access point for us. It's free, it's widely accessible, and the magazine, you obviously have to pay for it, and that's where we turn the profit. So the two work to balance each other out in kind of our business model in that way.
Sort of symbiotic as well. Obviously online, offering a platform for designers to be quite radical, to try things out, to push the boundaries of what's possible a bit within a set of kind of fairly loose but predetermined forms, is financially a little bit more viable, given that you're working on the internet, you have to change maybe some code, but you're not looking at investing heavily in a really expensive paper stock or inks that run up bills. So how do you negotiate that when it comes to print?
It's actually a little bit backwards. So online, we use the same template that our designers, Lita Sobierajski and Wade Jeffrey, designed for us a couple years back, and we don't change that. What we do, when we do give a designer kind of the run of the show, is with our triannual print magazines. So those are themed, and we work with a designer whose work kind of resonates with that theme and ask them to visually interpret that within the pages of the magazine. When it comes to how we justify expensive paper and inks, it's a little bit of a fluid conversation. We do get all of our paper donated in kind by Mohawk, so we do get quite a nice selection to choose from there. When it comes to expensive inks, this last issue number 2, the Psych issue, had a lot of Day Glow that was really expensive and gave us some trouble when it came to the cover. We like redesigned it on the printing room floor as it was at the printer. And that's really the editor is making a case to me that it's really important and that the couple $1,000 more is worth it on, you know, in the long run. And certainly for issue 2, it's just been flying off the shelves. So I feel very good about spending a couple extra $1,000 on that.
For sure. And it's also, you know, remaining sensitive to an audience and to their experience, where a big part of print is tactility, is kind of being able to engage with something in a different way, not just through your eyes, you know, through your hands, through how it smells, through how it looks.
Yeah, and we're also making this for one of the most critical audiences when it comes to design. So if we don't do right by them and give them something that is beautiful and works in a conceptual way as well, we've really failed, and they're going to call us out for it. I'll get all kinds of emails.
Perrin Drum from Ion Design, which has been certainly one of the mags I've really enjoyed following, well, in its relatively youthful existence so far. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum, I suppose, or with the magazine, a venerable title, a real heritage, prestige magazine. Different pressures, I guess, if you're stewarding a title like that, but no less pressure on the editorial staff. National Geographic, I'm talking about.
Right, and what's interesting about National Geographic, which earlier this year underwent this really big rebrand, is that given that it's a 130-year-long publication, it's focused on exploration, it's focused on discovering different corners of the globe, meeting new people, in its early days, you know, it's fairly safe to say that it had some pretty heavily colonial overtones, which just aren't appropriate now. So part of its rebrand has also been having to renegotiate its past and bring its kind of central principles and driving guidelines up to date. Emmett was fascinating. He spoke about really the importance of honing in on what makes National Geographic great, which we'll hear about now, and using that as the kind of fulcrum by which to bring it into the present.
The thing that you think about whenever you embark on a project like this is, what is the publication known for? And that, for National Geographic, is a very simple answer. It's photography, it's visual storytelling. And so every sort of decision that we made had that in the forefront of our mind. Our readers expect sort of deep narrative photojournalism from us, and we weren't going to take that away. We're going to keep giving it to them. What we aimed to do with the rebrand was put a bit more of an editorial voice and a structure around that photojournalism so that you really felt like you were in the hands of National Geographic as we took you sort of across the world into the sort of the geography of people, places, and ideas.
Obviously, as you say, you know, this editorial voice is important. Over the course of the history of the magazine, it's kind of faced or responded to the world in ways that maybe would be problematic now, in the same way as the discipline of anthropology has been forced to kind of really reevaluate. How important was navigating that past in looking forwards?
It's hugely important. It's one of the things that we talk about in the newsroom and editorial meetings every single day. As sort of the world has gotten to be a smaller place and we understand all of these sort of existing positions and viewpoints and perspectives around the world, you can't ignore them, and you need to find ways to sort of authentically report on other people and other places and other cultures without coming from, you know, this distinctly like East Coast US viewpoint. In that way, you know, we're looking for storytellers, for photographers, for reporters from all over the world. Our graphics department has people from China, from South America, from Spain, and it's bringing together all of these perspectives into one place that I think can really define what the coming voice of National Geographic will be, as opposed to sort of, you know, this historical voice very much, as you said, rooted in colonialism.
You mentioned, just before I turned the mic on, Instagram and social media and the kind of the change currency of the image and National Geographic's position within that. Could you just expand on that a little and talk about the expectations of audiences on the part of National Geographic's photojournalism?
So I think that Instagram and the iPhone and all of the other sort of devices have democratized photography in just an amazing way. There's so much more documentation going on now. It's so much more powerful. You see it, you know, the police interactions in the States where people are pulling out cameras and holding people accountable. And that's phenomenal. And we're looking for ways to take advantage of that. I think that the difference between Instagram, where we have, you know, a massive, massive audience, it's like 93 million now, and the photojournalism in the magazine, is that all of these places in the social sphere and online, all of this work is disaggregated. And when you put it into the magazine, into a 20 to 30 to 40 page long form narrative photojournalism report, you can capture more of those perspectives that we were talking about. You can capture more nuance in the story. I think the idea of the decisive moment is it maybe breaks down a little bit when you start to talk about complex issues, complex ideas, you know, emerging thought. Can you possibly capture sort of the modern non-binary views of gender in one image at this point in time? No, you takes an entire issue to sort of unpack that for people.
In terms of practical considerations you took in when you were rebranding, how long was that project gestating for? And where were you looking for kind of frames of references and inspiration?
So the project took longer than the CEO wanted. After the first conversation, he was sort of hoping we could have it all ready to go by the next issue, which unbeknownst to him was already printed. So I think, you know, I started making phone calls for folks to help us out around June, locked it down July, August-ish, and we were printing the May issue that it launched in, I believe, in February or early March. So it was good 6 months to make it through sort of the strategy and design phases of the project. As far as reference, you know, we're blessed with a 130-year history. There's sort of a deep well of typographic inspiration, of editorial inspiration, just in the magazine itself. So we looked at best practices from around the industry, but really sort of looked within and tried to mine the best of the ideas that had come before and sort of improve on them and modernize them. You know, we commissioned two new typefaces. We had just commissioned a new house stands for the entire company. So we use that, but the two new sort of editorial faces came from the magazine. One's based on Aldo Novarese's Egizio, and the other was this Gothic that we had found that I turned to type Twitter, no one could identify it. And finally called up a woman who had recently retired, had worked at National Geographic probably since 1888. And I said, Betty, you know, what is this? And she goes, oh, that's Fiedler Monogothic number 6. It's never been digitized. I'm like, this is why nobody knows what the hell it is. And so we gave those faces to our friend Tal Emming up in Baltimore at Type Supply to take a look at and to modernize, and went through, you know, whole bunch of rounds of revisions on both of them, but came up with these two typefaces, Earl, which is the Egyptian in there, and then Martin, which is the Sans, that we just love and feel like gives the magazine its own sort of editorial voice, even within the entire National Geographic ecosystem.
Emmett Smith from National Geographic. Before we end the programme, I'd like to hear from another person that you met at ModMag, and that's Tom Meredith, Creative Director at Elle. Tell us a bit about what Tom had to say to you when you caught up with him at ModMag.
Yeah, so Tom was a really interesting guy. He was talking about the fact that Elle is now kind of realising the audience's expectations have become more sophisticated. You know, elsewhere in the day's events, we heard about how magazine covers have been used as these really important political statements, especially in the US, often around race. And he spoke a bit about how audiences' expectations, you know, far from being diluted by online, are actually becoming more sophisticated. And the fact that Elle is realizing that, you know, in order to sell issues, it is going to have to do more interesting things with its covers to attract an audience that has a high standard.
There's a real understanding post this idea of print being dead, that print is just a different form of luxury now and a way of consuming things in a way that is physically luxurious and slower. And I think print magazines really have to adapt to that. And that's what we've been trying to do over the last year, is create something that isn't trying to do everything, because you can get everything so quickly online. And I think that was the big thing that we've been really talking about, what a cover should do and what the expectations of a cover should do. And I think sometimes we've gone between being very brave and doing like an anti-cover line edition. And then maybe if sales have been tricky, we've sort of lost a bit of confidence and gone back to doing something that's more traditional. And it's really interesting to see which ones have worked and which haven't. I think the more traditional format of a cover doesn't work anymore. And I think one of the most interesting issues we've done this year has been an issue on sustainability, which is a very difficult thing to do visually and with fashion and with our advertisers. But I think it's something that the industry is realizing that it has to engage with now, because young readers, they expect it of their fashion brands. They expect, if they're going to buy a magazine, they expect it to have the right values. And on that issue, we put Slick Woods on the cover, who is heavily pregnant. She's a black queer mother to be, and I think a lot of people were quite scared that it would bomb. And especially when you put that against something that doesn't sound very sexy, like sustainability. We had a really good consultant on that who works in Paris and worked for the Kering Group before, and she very much said, look, you have to be realistic about what you can do, and it's got to be something that becomes part of your manifesto going forward and that you can build on. And it actually was one of our best-selling issues of the year. It was uncover-mounted. It wasn't covered in a plastic bag. It didn't have a free mascara with it. And I think that's probably an issue that's going to be a starting point for where we'll move forward with the magazine.
So do you feel that there is this kind of appetite in the audience for like these covers that are making this sort of bold statement moving forward?
Yeah, and interestingly, I had dinner with a photographer from Elle, a proper icon, Gilles Bensimon, and he's still working. He's probably in his late 70s, and he was working on French Elle for a long time, and it's weekly, so it had to, every cover really had to have a point of view. And he said to me something like, oh, every cover has to be a question. And I think it's actually so relevant now. I think that's why independent magazines are actually doing so well and have such a healthy, solid readership, even if they're not huge. And I think advertisers are attracted to that and readers are attracted to that, because they're actually saying something very specific with that issue rather than trying to say everything.
That was Tom Meredith, Creative Director at Elle, talking to Augustin Machelori. Org, thanks for your reporting from ModMag. A jolly day, I'm sure you enjoyed. And thanks, of course, to Jeremy Leslie and all of his team at ModMag for the, as ever, warm welcome and for putting on another great day. That's it for the programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop me a note or write to fernando@fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.